Welcome back to the Ed Morrissey Show podcast. You just saw the Prince of Twitter, the Regent of RedState.com, Andrew Malcolm at AH Malcolm on the Twitterses, and of course, here every week to opine, although not next week. I'm going to be on vacation next week. So,
Oh my gosh. So the world will have to get along without us next week.
I can't imagine how that's going to happen either. It's just.
Things will go to hell, but. That gives us something to talk about the week after.
On the other hand, it might be that things get better because I'm gone, or at least in correlation to me being gone. You can never discount that possibility, right? Yeah. It might be that, and this is crazy. This is a crazy speculative thing that could happen with me being out, but the new managing editor of a major media outlet might apologize for being mean to us. Oh, wait a minute. Did that already happen? Was that already?
Yeah. Oh, that's a clever segue. Check that off, Ed. That's a good one. Yeah. Yeah. Lewis, the new head at the Washington Post. The New York Times ran a story about the tumult going on at the Washington Post, both financial and staff wise, and just payback for the Washington Post doing a story on the New York Times tumult a couple of years ago. In the story, they revealed that Will Lewis had tried to dissuade some people from writing about his exploits back in Britain, trying to suppress a story about him. And he wrote a staff-wide memo to the Washington Post apologizing and saying that humility was a lesson for him and he was going to work on implementing that.
I think that there are ways of saying things to people and maybe that's what he's apologizing for. But if he's apologizing for telling them that they've lost half their audience and they're losing another half of the half that remains, unless they make some serious changes. I mean, why apologize for that? It happens to be true.
Yeah, it does. They lost. I don't remember the time period, but they lost over 500,000 online subscribers. Sometimes they don't have them anymore, but sometimes they have cheap rates. But that's a significant chunk of change there that they didn't have. That wouldn't have covered, I don't think, the 77 million loss they had last year. They just seem to have lost focus. You can't blame it all on Sally Busby, the editor or the executive editor.
No, this was going on before Busby was put in place. Yeah. It's going on for a long time.
But their stuff did get softer. And I don't know, just from my experience, you had a sense reading, or at least starting to read a bunch of their stories, that there wasn't a strong editor in charge, not the top editor, but editor, working editor, working line editor, forcing reporters to write about stuff that was important rather than stuff that they just wanted to write about, and focusing the pieces on what really mattered.
Well, I mean, I think that's the part of the problem, though, is their assessment of what really matters, right? Yeah. Yeah. And that is not new. That wasn't Sally Busby. That had been going on well before Sally Busby. That was during the Marty Baron era, too, the legendary Marty Baron era. And that's because they began focusing on, narrative journalism rather than actual journalism. But one of the things that I find odd about even what Lewis had to say was that they're going to split the Washington Post into three newsrooms. There's going to be three separate newsrooms, right?
Yeah.
And I'm trying to find the reporting on this. It was at the Post. Let me see if I can find this. The plan includes splitting the newsroom into three separate divisions with managers who report to Lewis. One that encompasses Post's core news reporting, one with opinion pieces. I mean, every newspaper has an opinion editor, and it's supposed to be separate from the newsroom. It usually isn't, but it's supposed to be, right? But then, you know, the third one was devoted to attracting new consumers through innovative uses of social media, video, artificial intelligence, and sales. Well, that's not really a newsroom, right? That's, of that is. Because we've talked about that before, about how being on social media is certainly a tool for
trying to figure out what people want to read.
Yes.
My theory, and I'll shorten it here, but because we've talked about it before, but is that for a long time, monopoly newspapers, this before the internet, were arrogant, and they had the market basically to themselves, except television, which was following them, not shaping them. So they decided they were writing about what they wanted to write about. And you often had the opinion when you read print newspapers that the article was written not so much because they thought it was important, but because the reporter and the editor involved wanted the show that they worked yesterday. You started to read the story about City Hall and you go, so what? You know, I mean, it moves stories a quarter of an inch instead of several inches. And you over time, and not a long time, it build up a sense that, you know, I don't know, I don't really need this. You could skip an awful lot of the paper. I was in a meeting when the web was new, when we first met. Back at the beginning of Twitter, and the blog I was running on the LA Times was very successful, and it shocked the print people, sort of annoyed them. And one of the editors said, "Malcolm, you mean you would actually post a story because you thought people would want to read it?" And I said, "Well, John, you bet your sweet ass, yeah, because they want to read it." That was the point. Now, you know, you don't want to go all the way with that, because otherwise they'd just be stories about bare breasts, and you don't want to have the paper dominated by pornography, because you think people want to see it. That gets a lot of clicks, but they were not aware of what, or weren't thinking about what people wanted to read. And that's what online does now, sometimes too much, but that's the pendulum has swung back that way, away from the arrogance.
Yeah, you know, but here, I mean, I think what they were concerned about was pandering, and I get that, right? You want to do news reporting, even if it's not something that might be sexy to people, but if you think it's necessary, and that's a lot of beat reporting, right? You know, the city council beat, the police blotter sort of stuff.
Yeah.
The problem at the Post, though, is that they're not doing that sort of stuff anymore. What caught my eye about this is, one, I think that the newsroom that they're talking about is really marketing. That third newsroom is really marketing, not really reporting, not really a newsroom. There's nothing wrong with marketing. But if you think of it as a newsroom, then I think that you're already half giving the game away, because the whole idea of marketing is to sell, right? It's to pitch, it's to make a pitch. That's not what reporting is. That's not what newsroom reporting is, right? Opinion is for pitching. It's a pitching in a different sense. And that makes sense to keep it separate from the newsroom. But the newsroom is just the newsroom, or it should.
Yeah.
where you're reporting the facts and let readers draw their own conclusions, or move over to the opinion pieces and have people write opinions and columns that, opinion section, move over there so you can discuss the conclusions you're supposed to draw from this.
There was a day where reporters and newspapers reported sort of more passive, where they waited for things to happen, or their eyes were open, but they're always looking for something to write. Even if it was like one of my first stories is a dog finding a wallet and bringing it back to his owner. I mean, that.
Yeah.
It's more passive. But then we've switched because of the need to sell things more online. We move to too much sometimes to what do people want to read? Or what would, not necessarily that, but what would get a lot of clicks? And reporters think that they know that. And editors, I think, have a bigger picture view. And the Washington Post, like some other places, you get a sense reading them that it was only what reporters wanted to write about. And when you started to read the story, you didn't want to read about it. So the cost of belonging to the Washington Post didn't seem worth it. And a lot of people signed off. They were being told a narrative that they were supposed to believe. And a lot of people didn't, or didn't want to be told what to do. You know, there's a psychology to this, and this may be what he's talking about with the marketing, but my father had a wonderful trick that I have used. It's not a trick, it's a method that I have used with my kids and that they're using with their kids. And when we were at the swimming pool, which I absolutely loved, if he said, "All right, we have to go now," there was a meltdown. I wasn't happy about it. But you know what? And this is advice for grandparents, I guess. If you say, "Okay, 5 minutes, we're going up to the room," in 5 minutes or 6 minutes or 3 minutes, you could say, "Okay, time's up." And almost always, everybody's accustomed to it. They're prepared for it because psychologically, you made them receptive to that news. And yeah. The newspapers are trying to do that all the time with their narrative. The Washington Post, I think they got up to like 12,000 lies and mistruths that they alleged Trump had told. Every day they have a new listing because they knew this was really important and they wanted to drive that home for the narrative. And I guess it worked in 2020. They don't do any of that for Biden because he's the guy that they want in office. And right. Who was it? Somebody did a fact checking on a CNN interview he did, and Biden told 15 lies in a 17-minute interview.
Yes, yeah, it was on CNN. Yeah, I remember that. I think one of our writers covered it.
Yeah,
and another example of this would be what happened in Washington D.C. this past weekend, right? I mean the pro-Hamas demonstrations that vandalized the Marquis de Lafayette statue, among other things, were demanding, a global intifada, which is basically a pogrom of the Jewish people. And the Washington Post, covered it as sort of, it's a political demonstration that might be, a little uncomfortable for Joe Biden. It was basically Charlottesville, only nobody got killed, thankfully. But it was basically Charlottesville, minus the tiki torches, which create all sorts of outrage among the media, Washington Post included. And they started writing about the danger to democracy from the far right, that Donald Trump represented because of Charlottesville. One time. One time with some fringe radicals that showed up in Charlottesville, and somebody else ran down one of the counter protesters and killed her, which is terrible. And he's going to spend the rest of his life in prison, which is where he belongs. But you've got 8 months of this going on. And the Washington Post and the New York Times and blah, 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 blah. Well, you know, free speech. And as I think it was Peter Savodnik in the Free Press last night said, well, I'm glad that, you know, it's true. But it was also free speech in Charlottesville, too. You know, separate from the car attack that killed somebody. That was also free speech up to that point in time. And these and the media was calling it the end of democracy. And then creating Donald Trump for trying to excuse people defending the Confederate monuments. And you got Joe Biden doing the same damn there's fine people on both sides of the issue thing with these guys for the last 8 months. Wow. And the Washington Post, you know, we're kind of going over the same old territory with bias. But I mean, I think that the events of this past weekend shows that whatever is happening at the Washington Post, it's either not happening fast enough or it's not happening at all in terms of turning that ship around.
Speaking of my column.
That's a I've had enough of this topic. Let's talk about me segue right there. Yes. Yeah, speaking of your column, because this is actually a really interesting question and we're getting closer to the, decision point here. You have something. Here is how Trump is picking his successor. And I have a number of thoughts on that, but let's hear my thoughts are not very charitable on that. I'll get to that, but you tell me how you see Donald Trump going through the Veep Stakes decision. I think it's going to be pretty much the same as everybody does, but
it's well, and there's nothing wrong with this. It's just that he is so good at stretching this thing out and making it into marathon coverage about himself. And that is, who's he going to pick? And there are leaks about everybody. I haven't seen the leak yet about you or me, but it could come along, and it gets him in the news cheap. Just somebody says, ooh, he might pick Glenn Youngkin, or ooh, what about Nikki Haley? And once again, we go back to it's about clicks. And so I decided to write a piece about how he's doing that. And the masterfulness or masterfulity, I don't know. Anyway, the great skill that he's using to stretch this out, which of course is the same skill he used to make The Apprentice such a big rating success online. Ooh, is he going to get fired next week? Who's going to be here? Who's the next celebrity? He is a showman. He's always been a showman, but that honed his skills. He made a lot of money, 14 years out of it, and a lot of fame. And I don't think he'd be where he is today if he hadn't actually had done that show.
No.
That got him into everybody's living room on Sunday evening. So I wanted to write about it, not so much to provide a list. We mentioned some names of people who might be possible candidates. Marco Rubio, but then that's got the 12th Amendment problem. They're both from Florida. It's the same problem, I think, with Byron Donalds. He could, and this is what, I mean, we're talking about it. We're talking about him, which is exactly what he wants. I don't think, you know, last time he did it, I think, was sick, 48 hours before the convention. He announced Mike Pence. And I think we should factor that into our thinking. One, he's going to do it late or maybe even at the convention. I mean, wouldn't that be a rating success? He says, and now here's my pick. And the cameras go over and onto the stage walks the next vice president, who would also, if Trump wins, it would also be the heir apparent for 2028. So yeah. there's a double sweepstakes here. There will be a contest in 2028 Ron DeSantis' term ends in 2027. He's term limited. Yep. Nikki Haley will be around, although she seems to have made a lot of enemies at the moment. So there will be others emerging that the media will seize on to write about. But the important thing to Trump is who's loyal. And one of the biggest, most loyal, verbally loyal people in recent times has been Doug Burgum, the governor of North Dakota. So that doesn't get Trump anything in the Electoral College. It's just three of them, three votes, and North Dakota has gone Republican in every presidential election since 1968. But so here we are talking about it. It's normal, but it's not been this big a deal in the past, as we haven't had a president trying to get reelected after 4 years out of office. Grover Cleveland. Yeah.
And some of our viewers may think that we were around for Grover Cleveland too, but we actually weren't.
I remember I said to Grover, we called him Grover because we were so plugged in.
I called him Grow. It's a Grow, baby. Go ahead.
You know, some people call him GC, but
the big G.
G-Man, yeah. Who was a Democrat, you know, and that his big claim to fame, he was the first president to lose an election and then come back and win. But he was also the Democrat who broke the Republican supremacy that Republicans had earned from the Civil War and Reconstruction. Yeah. And they had like almost 32 years uninterrupted of dominance in the White House.
Yeah, also kind of mediocrities. And Grover Cleveland actually was sort of part of that whole mediocrity phase. We had mediocrities before the Civil War. We had mediocrities after the Civil War. Abraham Lincoln was sort of singular right in the middle of the century.
Amazing.
Yeah. But just to get back to the VP stuff. First off, I agree with you. First off, this is terribly normal. And I've been telling people this, who were insisting that he was going to name a running mate in April or May. It's like, he's not going to do that. He's going to, just like every other candidate, he's going to milk this until right before the convention. And in this case, there's even more reason to do that, because his sentencing hearing in Manhattan is going to be July 11th. And he's going to want to change the narrative pretty quickly after that. So don't expect to know anything about the...
Absolutely.
Until maybe the day after sentencing.
You know, in last winter in an interview, he said he'd already made up his mind. But after that show, he quickly realized he shouldn't be giving that up. That's a lot of free publicity.
Well, as Rod Blagojevich said, it's an effing valuable thing. he was talking about a different kind of appointment. But yeah, the power of picking people for these seats is very powerful. And you want somebody who's going to play ball with you, or you want somebody who can deliver something that you just simply can't get. And that kind of, I mean, Nikki Haley hasn't been on these lists, but I think that she's at least got to be somewhere in the mix, because Haley does speak to some disaffected Republicans who are very, very, still very, very Trump skeptical and may not turn, maybe reluctant to turn out, even with Joe Biden being as bad as he is. That's a kind of marriage of convenience that you will often.
Well, you know, and it should be picking a vice president. A major factor should be, is this person qualified to become president?
Yes.
Even though it isn't planned. That's not always what happens. People or presidential candidates pick people who add to their political equation. Joe Biden was phoned waiting in a dentist waiting room when Obama offered him to run on the ticket. George W. Bush had Dick Cheney, because of his long Washington experience, do the exploration, the background checks on all the possible candidates, and then Remember in the driveway at his Texas ranch, Bush announced that he had picked the guy that was searching for the pick.
Right. Yes.
Dick Cheney, who brought a lot of, he had to change his residency to Wyoming for that 12th Amendment business, but he had a lot, he brought a lot to the ticket, long Washington experience in the White House, the Defense Department, Congress. He was older, so he brought some gravitas, he did not have any of his own personal presidential ambitions, which could distract a younger person. And that's one thing I'm sure that Trump is thinking of. He doesn't want a partner who's going to hog the publicity limelight. Pence was great at that. Pence was very loyal and obedient and did not cause ruffles. Remember, even Biden, I think this is probably stupidity on his part, but Biden got out ahead of Barack Obama on gay marriage, and that embarrassed Obama, and he had to play catch up. But you want a vice president partner who's going to be obedient, loyal, and sure, likely they're building their own reputation, but they do that through Trump. And Doug Burgum, if he has larger political ambitions, he could do that through Trump. He's not well known, so everything that he gets will come from Trump.
Yeah, he's kind of a Gates Foundation sort of Republican, though. I mean, Beige is...
I'm not arguing for him. I'm explaining the expediency that would argue for him.
Yeah, the other point, though, is the idea that vice presidents assume the mantle of leadership without, you know, after a complete term, right? I'm not talking about when a president dies in office, because then obviously the office passes to them. But we've only had, I think, three former vice presidents that were elected president just on the basis of them being vice presidents, at least in the modern era. You had George H.W. Bush. You had Richard Nixon, and it took him two times, right?
Yeah.
to succeed at that. And that's, I think, right. The previous one to that is Martin Van Buren. And that's it. Yeah.
It's not been an automatic ticket. But no. And actually, George H.W. Bush was basically, I believe, elected because it was a third Reagan term. Yeah, there was a lot of goodwill that carried over from Reagan, and said, well, let's keep it going. But, you know, Al Gore, it didn't help Al Gore. It didn't help Mondo,
but I mean, Carter's presidency was a disaster. But, you know, Mondo had been around for a while.
And... Oh, yeah, he had a congressional thing, and he tried a little gambit to by picking a woman partner who was a member of the House, which I think is a disaster if you do that, because Americans don't, you know, no offense, but Americans don't hold House members in high esteem.
Some of those House members too, Andrew.
No, they don't. And I don't think they necessarily should. So that didn't help him. And then, of course, the displays of, or the revelations about some problems she had in her background. But Democrats, I mean, if Trump was a Democrat, we would know that he was going to pick someone from the Senate. Democrats always do that. It's just, I don't know why, because it doesn't really help them.
Well, it's because they're much more focused on federal power than they are on distributed power. I mean, it really actually kind of makes sense. The Democrats want to centralize power in Washington, D.C., and Republicans, for the most part, want distributed power to the states. It's the reason why Republicans look to governors, right?
Exactly.
And or in Trump's case, outsiders, right?
Yeah.
They're all basically outsiders. I don't remember. I think the last insider that ran on the as the top line of a Republican ticket was Bob Dole.
And then that didn't work out too well. Yeah.
Well, maybe Nixon, well, Ford did, but Ford was running for re-election. Or not re-election, but he was running for his first election, I should say. He wasn't elected, he was appointed. But then I think it's Nixon who was an insider. He was, you know, Senate, House and Senate and vice president. But
Jimmy Carter picked Mondale, like you say, for the reasons of centralized power, but also because Jimmy Carter was a relative unknown in 76. That was a big deal because everybody was tired of Washington and Nixon and Watergate and all the sordid details from there. So they wanted somebody new, and he took the nomination basically by storm. I remember one of my New York Times reporters telling me he was covering Iowa for the caucuses, and he said he knew that Jimmy Carter was had a good leg up because every house he went to, and you know, local in the living rooms like New Hampshire, that's where the caucuses are won. Every house he went to, the guest book had been signed by Jimmy Carter.
Well, you know,
it works. And he's from a small town. It still lives in a small town. And so that he knows that intimately. And that's very powerful if small town culture is something that's useful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're almost
that's the column.
That's the column. And now I'm going to put you on the spot. Who do you think he's going to pick?
I don't know. I once a long, long time ago, I laughed when someone said Trump was going to be president. So I try to stay away from that. But predictions. But I made a case for why Burgum could be. I don't think Trump is looking for ideological purity. He's looking for personal loyalty. And that's why I don't think he's going to pick Nikki Haley, as strong as that would be. I hope he doesn't pick a nobody, like someone from the House or something. That's a waste. He is the power behind the ticket. There's no doubt about that. But if you would like to enhance the power of the ticket rather than just, who cares who's vice president? That's why Biden picked what's her name, is because she checked boxes, and not because she'd make a good president.
He said it explicitly, I'm going to pick a black woman.
Yeah.
I'm going to pick a black woman. He made that commitment. And
wait a minute, a person who identifies as a black woman, right?
Fine woman, right? He would have been better off picking Val Demings, who's a lot smarter than Kamala Harris, just as progressive, but a lot smarter. I'm going to guess
And Val. Oh, wouldn't that be a Joe and Val?
Joe and Val,
Joe Val.
I'm going to Joe Val. Sounds like a perfume commercial. Joe
Val. Yes.
You have to do the weird dance, right?
With filmy negligee like material in front of the camera.
And some weird opera aria playing in the background, and it's Joval.
That's great.
Yeah, but if it was Joe and Val, the aroma would not be.
Yeah, right.
I can tell you the aroma would be something less than perfumish. Anyway, I'm going to go out there on a limb and say Nikki Haley might be his choice, not because he doesn't get along with her, or not because he gets along with her. I think actually when they were in the administration together, they worked together pretty well.
They worked together very well. I understand she talked back to him a couple of times at the UN. Who was that? Tillerson was giving her gas. And she went around him because one of her demands was that she be in the cabinet, not just a member of the diplomatic corps. And that was very smart on her behalf. No, she's in terms of being president, there's a lot of Trumpers, I guess, who don't like the fact that she criticized him, but she'd be a good president.
So that's my pick.
That would be good.
Because they did work well together, and she is a governor, and she's got the credibility. Nobody's mentioning her name, though, and I'm kind of thinking that maybe it's because she's been discouraging it. But we'll see. Yeah. I think that she would make Sarah Huckabee Sanders would make a good running mate for him. And I think that he kind of needs to have something.
Wait a minute. You're seeing Sarah?
I thought you said
Nikki.
No, I'm going to stick with Nikki, but I think Sarah Huckabee Sanders would be a good choice too. But
I don't think
she wants. So
no. Well, she's got her. See, if you're thinking about your own career, if you want to build your own career from where it is now, you don't want it. But if you're a nobody like Burgum, this would thrust you in.
Good point. All right. Well, that's about it for this show, except for, of course, the jokes. Yeah,
I have one.
Okay.
This is an old one, Seth Meyers. He said, scientists are attaching sensors to sharks to help hurricane forecasting. They hope the data saves enough lives to offset those lost by swimmers attaching sensors to sharks. That's a good point. Yeah.
I wondered about that. All right. I got a couple of quick ones for you. Man's browsing through an old newspaper. He says to his wife, hey, this is interesting. There's an article in here about men losing their memory cells faster than women do. And she said, well, it must be true because it's the second time you've read me that. And this one's a PG-13 one. So a teen boy goes into the drugstore to buy a pack of condoms for the first time. So he sees the price is $10, but when he goes to the register, it rings up for $10.65. And the teenager says, what's the 65 cents for? And the cashier says, it's for the tax. He goes, oh, I was wondering how you keep it on.
Oh! Oh.
Ouch. Oh. Ouch, baby. Ouch.
Oh, wow. That's a hell of a note to stick with for 2 weeks, but okay.
Oh, there you go. Well, we can just put a pin in that one, I guess. Andrew Malcolm, the prince of Twitter, the regent of redstate.com, at @ahmalcolm on the Twitterses. We will talk again in 2 weeks, and we'll have a lot more to cover at that point in time.
Have a wonderful time, and don't get too, in a hot tub. Anyway, we'll see.
Shriveled.
Don't get too. Yeah. That's right. All right, buddy. Take care. Bye, everybody.